few months later, I'm at home and then my phone rings. It's a number I don't recognize. Hello? Dave Gary, player. Jeez, Mr. Player, how are you? Wow, wow, wow. Exchange pleasantries. He said, listen, my boy, I've got an entourage of press out here from the US. And we're doing, my new book is going to be my 18 favorite holes in South Africa. And I've done most of them, but I'm stuck on the 11th hole at Royal Johannesburg in Kensington. So, well, Mr. Player, you know, I don't have a story for you right off the top of my head, but if I plow my mind, I'll think of something, I'll do some homework, and I'll come back to you with a cool story about the 11th. So there's a pause, and he goes, didn't you hear about that prick whose taser gun went off in his pocket?
The whole time, Dave this, Dave no, this, shame. Dave that. Shame.
You're beautiful, Ekmarko.
Shame, he said exactly the same thing about you, Dave.
And I don't think there's one guy who'll talk cuck about Mark.
Mm-mm. He's a beautiful Literally. Man.
Oh, is it?
No, he's such
he's
a good guy.
He's just an all-rounder.
And you know, like, we've done a lot of stuff. So my wife and I've got a charity, a trust that we've had for a long time. So we've raised millions of rand for children's education. Because I'm adopted. So I'd always...
Ah, you adopted.
Yeah. So I had a... I was really fortunate that my parents explained that to me. So when I was 12, I was head boy of my primary school. And then I got on the Johannesburg Junior City Council. So I had to go and do a thing at the Joburg Children's Home. And I saw all these kids and I thought, I could be a million different people. It was, I promise you, I'm even emotional, I'll tell you now. So I was very fortunate to just get amazing parents, you know. And my dad today, I speak to my dad every day of my life for the last 30 years. He's an amazing guy. So I decided to help children. And it's been cool because there's been some amazing stories, you know, of children that came from tough, and because you go there, you could be anybody. And the way you grow up and the way you're influenced by particularly your parents is so powerful, you know. So I was really fortunate to have that in my life. And as a result, we created this thing. So what we did for fun, I used to play a minimum of 200 holes in one day. And then we'd get people to give pledges per hole that I played.
Okay.
So people thought I could maybe play 36 holes.
Yeah.
And then I said, well, I'll give you 5 rand a hole. And then I came back and said, I played 200. It's 1,000 rand you owe me. It changed the dynamics, you know. And I think I played 256 in one day at Humewood many years ago to help a young black boy who was at school at St. Andrews was going to go on this rugby tour and couldn't afford it. So we did this thing. Anyway, raised a lot of money. And I played on the very first hole. It was a windy day at Humewood. And I lost my second shot. I hit it over the green in the bush. I played the next 255 holes with the same ball. And I was sponsored in those days by Strata and Toflight Mizuno. And this ball looked like an unmade beta. And I took all the scorecards and framed it with a ball in the middle, which I think they had in their boardroom for quite a long time. But, you know, that's continued. And my wife's an amazing person. So we did a golf day recently, 2 weeks ago. There was a young boy with a crazy, crazy condition called autoimmune encephalitis. And these two twin boys were born. And the one has got a problem and the other one's a perfect, beautiful children. So we had to, well, we didn't have to, but our intention was to raise 150,000 rand. And we ended up raising 350,000 rand. So, you know, it's not about them necessarily, about that family, but it's a condition that there are lots of families have this and no one knows what it is because it's a relatively new condition. And I suppose it's the food we eat and the way we live these days.
What is the condition? How do you get affected? What's the effect?
So encephalitis, which I had as a kid, is when the fluid around your brain sort of expands and it creates pressure and whatever. In those days, I had one of those big injections in my back. I don't know what it's called. Epidural. No, that's for if you're
pregnant. I hear what you're saying. That's pregnant. Spinal.
Like a spinal block or something.
Yes. Yeah, so I had that and obviously alleviates the problem. But this goes on, and this little boy has several fits. He can have fits quite regularly, you know. So through medication and everything, that decreases, and he can slowly start living a normal life. So this little boy is about 3 and a half, but he can't talk yet, while his brother is just the most beautiful. He runs around like a normal little boy, you know, and they're two beautiful children. So we're really touched by this family. And the small, in the short term, is to help them with medication requirements, but in the long term is to get more people to be aware of this condition. And his mother, Tanita, a lovely lady, she's going to climb Kilimanjaro out of an awareness for this condition. Because you can imagine how many people in rural areas and with respect, uneducated communities who have got no clue what this is about. And you know what happens is, and when I was fortunate living in Mauritius, we found a little school for disabled children. And there was a boy there who was clearly very uncomfortable in his chair, and he had problems. And he had this old broken wheelchair. And I went there, and I saw this, and it really touched my heart. So we went, and we made a commitment to raise money to help this boy. And we needed to raise 80,000 rupees, which is probably the equivalent of about 30,000 rand, to buy him a chair, a proper wheelchair. And we raised 1 million rupees. And we were able to, the following year, we raised another 1.5 million rupees, and we were able to build a proper playground for children with problems, you know. And it was really fulfilling. But that was because of golf. And, you know, sometimes we focus so much on playing golf, which we all do. We love it, and we frustrate the hell out of each other and whatever. But we have a great time. But you look at stuff beyond golf, you know. And, I mean, it's well documented that in America, they raise more money than any other sport in the world for charity and predominantly for children. You know, you've got children. I've got two beautiful children that mean the world to me. And I wanted them always to have stuff, you know. I want them to live in a normal life. But there's so many children don't have that privilege. So if we can help children, that's been my mission for most of my life, you know. But golf has been the key, because I don't have a lot of money. But I know a lot of people with money, and they supported my dream and they've helped me, and it's been meaningful, you know. So that's something I'm really grateful for through golf. It's pretty cool stuff, you know.
You know, Dave, it's very personal. My mom was a teacher for mentally disabled kids for 20 years. I've also got an adopted brother that has got also mental challenges. So it's very close to my heart. And it's just amazing to me how emotionally you get when you talk about this. Because part of the purpose that Arthur and I always speak about is that golf is beyond the fanciness and the snobbishness that's normally connected or attached to the game of golf. But the game of golf, the people that play golf, is just amazing. And how they raise money for charities, how they use the vehicles and the cash flow that's perhaps available to that sport to do better with, to make an impact with. And there's amazing people in golf that do that. And I'm also, what I'm so proud of you, Dave, to pass on, because I see it in Michael, that you raise consciousness that we can't just live for ourselves. We can't just always wake up every day with our own agenda. We also have to play a bigger role in what we do. And like you said, you know, you've taken golf and made that the vehicle for you to make an impact on that.
But I totally agree with you, and I appreciate your thoughts about that. But somebody needs to be an example to you. And I've been so fortunate that, firstly, my dad is just an amazing guy. I was very fortunate to spend a lot of time with Dale Hayes. I think Dale is, it's quite an emotional conversation for me. But Dale's an amazing guy. And I don't think he gets the credit he deserves for what he's done for so many people through golf, using the vehicle of golf. And Peter Matkovich, who I was very privileged to work for a period of time, I saw a human being that is just unbelievable. He's so passionate about what he does, and he has uplifted so many people. And a guy called Andrew Schwegman, who was a developer. I met him a little later in my life, but he was a developer at Abbotsy, one of the kindest, most beautiful people I ever met. And along the way, there's lists of those people that I've been fortunate to have used as mentors, have been mentors to me, you know. So I've always really strongly believed in passing things forward, because I've been given a lot of breaks. I've been given a huge amount of opportunities. Some I've taken and done well with, others I haven't done particularly well with. But I guess that's part of growing up. Along the way, I've met so many amazing people. My dear friend Andy Bean, who is now the CEO or general manager at the River Club. I mean, a beautiful man who has got such a big influence on so many people. So, I mean, very fortunate with it. And I think I've always been cognizant of the fact that you need to take some things out of these conversations and relationships that you have over time. So I've been fortunate with that, you know. And I think that's also helped me pass it forward to other people. I love talking to the young professionals. I love talking to young club pros, guys getting into the industry. I'm still very proud of being a member of the PGA of South Africa, and I'm been a board member for some time. And I've become, you know, as I've got a little grayer and older and supposedly wiser, that's debatable. But, you know, it's really encouraging for me to spend time with some of the young pros and share ideas with them, because I think there's not enough information is shared. A lot of people hold on to whatever they have. So I think sharing things is really important, and helping people see things. A lot of things that I did was not relevant. So you need to be relevant. And I think the most important word for me, particularly in this time of our lives, is disruption. You know, there's been so many things that have been disrupted. Either you go with it or you fight against it. Unfortunately, I don't believe you can. So you have to be relevant about what you're doing and why you're trying to do it. And not everything's a good idea, but I think sharing stuff is cool for me.
I heard a saying from Mercedes's Mercedes dealer principle, Formula F1 principle, Toto, I think it's Toto something. And he said, we will not hesitate to be brave for the future. And we spoke a little bit before we went on here about you approaching players and making an impact with them, having conversation with them. And this is part of what we try and do here, is that brutal honesty is such a, to me, it's so missing lately. When somebody comes to me and says, Albert, you know, what happened there? I think you could have done that slightly better. When somebody takes that time to be positively critical about what I do, I find it from a place of love, because you've taken the time to do so, but also the braveness in that we should be able to speak to each other in a very direct way and say to each other that, you know, my father always said to transfer, real empowerment is transferring one skill to another. You know, and you taking the time, because you can just walk past a lot of the stuff that you see, Dave, but you stop, you take a little bit of attention to it, and you say, what can I do or say here or guide in order to make an impact on that player's life going forward? And like you say, you get these messages afterwards from grandmas and et cetera, because the impact that you have on those people, and you're taking the time. Dave, that's an incredible skill and a very selfless way of looking at life and what you do. So that's why we're so privileged this morning to have you sitting here with us in this room. You know, Dave, when I speak to you, and from the moment I dealt with you and everybody I always speak to, you make yourself accessible. You know, you're a busy man. You're a big man and a big legend in the game, but you make yourself accessible. You take the time, you've directed me and taken a few moments where you said, Albert, you know, let's look at that differently, or that stuff sits with me forever. And Arthur has the same experiences with you, and every person we've spoken about has that experience with you, Dave. So your parents that adopted you, there was clearly a big plan for you and your life, Dave. And your humbleness when you speak about success is also very endearing, because I think you've been far more successful than you think. And I think the legacy that you will have if you leave us tomorrow is incredible on the South African fields and Mark. South African field, on the golf course or the golf industry. And without me subbing any further, that is a big thank you. And Arthur and I spoke about this. We want you to sit here this morning, other people to be inspired by you and what you do, but also to know, you spoke about all the big hearts in golf. We don't have to be attitude people. We don't have to be snobbish people. We mustn't. Life is past that point now. You know, we have to be real in what we do. I say to people or the golfers, you know, you spoke about being thankful for the sponsors that are with you. A businessman, you know, he puts his C63 AMG and he takes a photo and he puts it on Instagram. And I always say, what's the impact of that? Show me the factory you've built in order to afford whatever you want to. That's far more reach and impactful than you showing the end result. Because what do I do with that? It's like, oh, I don't have that car. So now, am I not successful? Am I, you know, what? But rather show me, no, I started with a little shop. Then I went into this. Then I went into this. And now 5 years later, hard work, a lot of effort, a lot that went into it, I can afford to buy myself a decent car. As an example, if that's your ambition. We need to be brave about having those conversations and changing the mindsets. You spoke about professional players and Eric van Rooyen as well, about there's a difference between being cocky, being arrogant, and being confident. Yeah, there's a difference between that approaches. And sponsors as well. You know, why do you want to be with the guy that's like the guy that ignores everybody, that doesn't greet the caddies as he walks onto the course, the one that ignores the ground staff that put the whole thing together? Michael Scott said it when he sat here, and he was thanking caddies. Thank you for the contribution you do towards the golf. All the people at 4 o'clock in the morning sit there on the coldest of Saturday morning. Thank you for preparing that course to us. And I think that if we can raise that consciousness that we must be deliberate with each other. We must always, it's not just about yourself. You know, it's about the impact that you have around you. Allow me just this, and with Davia this morning, PGA Pro and board member. He is a brand ambassador for so many brand. He's a father to two wonderful kids, a husband. He's a mentor to so many people in this game. He's a businessman in golf and an overall legend in the game. So, Dave, thank you so much for your time today and sitting down with me and Arthur.
Oh, I really appreciate it. I think it's cool sometimes to have a different platform to share a different story, you know. We're talking about a little earlier. I think Arthur, you said we met when you were 7 years old. You know,
somewhere around there, yeah.
You got on to Swaziland, and that's when I first met Nombushle Dlamini, a young lady.
Yeah, we were juniors together.
On. Yeah. Mm. And in those days, what we used to do was I would go and help. I would take Llewellyn van Loon came with me a few times. And we'd go and spend a weekend down there at no cost. They used to just look after us in terms of accommodation and food. There was an amazing man there called Patrick. Oh, my. They had a chicken farm. Just a lovely, lovely man. And him and his wife used to look after us. And we used to go and give lessons to all the young kids there.
I'll get his name to you now. Patrick, I've got it. Yeah, it's in the back of my mind.
And Lizzie was his wife.
Patrick Russell.
You're 100% right. Just a most delightful man. A passionate man about everything. Again, a person who taught me things. But we would go down there and just have a good time and teach all these young kids. And they would come, you know, from far to come and have a golf lesson. And what I did was, back in those days, the guys who distributed Etonic golf shoes, we'd go and get all the old golf shoes. And I'd go down there with a truckload of golf shoes and we'd hand them out to the children. And when you'd see them the next time, they had put glue on the bottom, when they'd found some sparks, or they got new laces, and they used to carry them around their neck like we did when we went to rugby practice. Mm. And they'd get to the range and they'd all put in their shoes, and then we'd do lessons, and there was no one giving you mouth back, you know. I'd go to a kid in some of the clubs and I'd say, don't go there, don't tell me what to do. Like, wow, you know, it was so the basics were there, and we'd give these kids lessons. Then we had the most wonderful experience. There was a young boy there, and forgive me for not remembering his name, but he showed the most promise. And somehow, I think through your mom,
wasn't it Robert Sheba?
It could have been you.
He's working at Inconieni now.
Yeah, so your mom, you know, she was an amazing, well, she is an amazing lady, but in her contribution to golf was just so significant in the development of Swazi golfers. So this young guy, I got him a clothing sponsorship from Pringle, okay? And back in the day,
was Robert.
Yes, everything was Argyle. And
I still rate Pringle. Like, I don't know. I still love their clothing.
Great stuff, but in those days, he looked like one of those pimps in an American movie, you know? He had all the kit. But this poor guy had never been on an escalator. He had never had an ice cream. And he, with a chaperone, they flew up to Joburg. He spent the day. He did all those things to prepare him for what he was going to face overseas. He went to play in the Junior British Open. Mm. And he finished in the first round. He finished double, double, double. And the guy who was chaperoning him, again, forgive my memory, had said to him, you know, what happened? And he said, I was thirsty. He said, well, why didn't you ask me for some water? I would have given it. He didn't know he could do that. He ended up, I think he finished like sixth or seventh in the tournament, and he ended up having lessons with David Ledbetter. And to his credit, he went back to Swaziland, and he stayed there, and he's done a huge job, and he's been an influence to people out of his own, you know. Mm-hmm. And I suppose that was the shining light in that space. But Nobushle's dad, who ran the driving range,
Jonas.
A lovely man, you know. And we'd go down there and he'd have all the kids there, and it was like an event, you know. We'd try and go there every 6 or 8 weeks, and we loved it. We had a great time, and the guys who went with me, Llewellyn being one of them, I think we all learnt a lot, you know. We had some pretty good evenings at your parents' house. They were quite liberal with the wine and stuff. it was all good. You know, we had a great time. And now, how long ago is that? That's probably 25 years ago.
Yeah, pretty much.
And so to sit here and reminisce about those things, stuff you almost forget, you know. But I suppose in the context of what we're talking about, and you've gone on to play on the tour, realize, fortunately, with the greatest respect, that that's not your calling, and gone into fitting and helping people with the equipment, which is such an important part of playing golf.
Correct.
A lot of people, you know, you walk into a shop and get a deal because it's, you know, the cheapest price or it's affordable. But actually, that's like running the comrades in your flip-flops. You can do it, but it's not so lekker, you know. So getting equipment, and that's what you've done exceptionally well. So it's amazing, 25 years of just so many things, you know. It's amazing.
But Dave, going back 24, you say you adopted. I want people to know, you know, inspire us a little bit and other people that maybe, you know, is also adopted. But you've made it. Just tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I think, you know, as I said, you know, my parents were just amazing. And they always told me about it, but I never understood it until that experience.
But they told you from a young age.
Yeah, that you know, we found you at this place and you're a special little boy and all that. And then, as I say, when I went through that experience of going to the home, I actually became, fortunately not for a long time, I was a little rebellious because I thought, you know, why did my parents give me away? Who are these people telling me what to do? Blah, blah, blah. And my folks never deviated from the plan. And I thought, you know, they've never reacted to my negativity. Then I fast forward a little bit, and I came across a family that had a problematic child. And it fascinated me. And I went to this lady, and I said, you know, I've seen you and your husband are upstanding members, citizens, blah, 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 but your son is a troublemaker, you know. And this woman started crying. And I thought, what's going on? So I said, what is the problem? She said, no, she told me a whole long story. So I said, let me speak to this boy. I went into his bedroom, we closed the door, and I spoke to him for 2 hours. And he changed because I knew what he is going through, but I didn't do it the way he did it. And it helped him. And as a result, I ended up counseling quite a few children who, because there's this terrible feeling of not belonging to anything. You know, like you've been discarded and someone else has picked up the pieces and now you've got to live your life, you know, and you've got to live your life. So that's why I say it's so important, the influencing factors around how that is. So being adopted is, when I was small, being adopted, when I was a young guy, I wasn't comfortable about it. But it's nothing, it's a blessing to be adopted. And then, you know, how it all works, because we see so many sad things with children and children being abused and parents who don't care, or, you know, I see a guy who gets divorced and then never sees children again. I mean, it's beyond me to comprehend that. As I said, I speak to my dad every day of my life, and I speak to my kids every day of my life at least 3 times. It's such a massive part of my life, you know. So, and it's just a hard thing, but it's not a bad thing. It's not an indifferent thing. It's, you know, you get dealt some cards. Sometimes they're not the ones that you're looking for, but you've got to make the best of them. And it is an attitudinal thing, you know. So attitude is influenced by lots of things. It's all easy to say, you know, have a better attitude. Yeah. But attitude is based on some fundamental things that need to be in place. So being encouraged and being made aware of what you do well. You know, unfortunately, let's just go to golf. We finished playing golf. The three of us have played golf. And a guy walks past and he said, how did you play today? Not one of the guys said, do you know I hit the best 6 iron I ever hit in my life? So I had 4 3-putts and hit in the water twice. Well, who cares about that? Yeah. That's how we are. We're wired like that. We talk about negativity so much. But if you switch that around and said, you know, I drove the ball exceptionally well today. What did you score? It doesn't matter. I achieved something today that was nice for me. We don't do that enough. I'm as guilty as everybody else. Okay. So, but it isn't, it's a paradigm shift in terms of the way you approach life and the conversations that you have. Because you can't underestimate how many people are listening to you, how many people are taking direction from what you do. And I see a lot of leadership roles where leaders are about themselves. And I mean this in the best possible way, but these guys who are CEOs of big corporate companies and make millions and millions of rands, I'm not saying they don't deserve that, but there's a guy who's doing an equally important job who's getting paid nothing and no recognition.
Yeah.
So in my journey, I was very, very fortunate to go to Mauritius for a couple of years, and I worked for the Four Seasons Hotel. And there was another amazing man there, a guy called Michel Volk. He was the general manager, which is, you know, the top of the pile there. And there was an accountant who remains a good friend of mine, who now is in Hawaii. And probably the first accountant I ever met in my life with a sense of humor. This guy looked like Robin Williams, and he was funnier than Robin Williams. But the fundamentals of Four Seasons was about recognition, but they prepared people to be recognized because they didn't, you know, that sometimes you can get you got a new job, and they say, well, here's your desk, here's your computer, here's the front door keys, good luck. Mm. There's no orientation process. There's no cultural share. You know, Four Seasons have got 115 hotels around the world. Every one of those hotels in a different destination. They go there and they embrace that culture. So you go to Mauritius, where some of the most beautiful people in Mauritius, they can't help you enough. It's just a delightful culture. So they go and they understand that culture. But at the same time, they're results driven. They need to get bums in beds. They need to make money. So they then share that culture, and slowly those cultures morph into one that you've got a business that works and you've got people that love doing what they do. So Those were exceptional experiences for me. But the point was recognition. You know, you'd have a meeting, any meeting, somebody was getting recognized for something. And it might be the smallest thing. An example was we had, at a point, I think I had about 60 different country flags for the 18th hole. So if there was an Italian football coming, there was an Italian flag on the 18th hole. And behind them was a Belgian football, there's a Belgian flag, and so on. And there was a guy who did that, especially in the busy time, you know, it was, but the impact it made on those people was really cool. It was like a small thing. I think a lot of people do it now, but at the time it was pretty cool. Then the guy in the cart barn, he came to me in the cart barn. He was in charge of the carts in Kingsley, lovely guy. He said to me one, and they used to call me Mr. Dave. My surname's terrible. So he said, Mr. Dave, you know, you always put flags on the 18th green. For different countries. Why don't you have a birthday flag? I said, wow, Kingsley, that's such a cool idea. So phoned and got some birthday flags. So if we knew, and the detail that Four Seasons goes to in terms of the guests, we knew that it was your birthday on the 5th of January. When you got to the 18th, there was a happy birthday flag. I saw people cry when they saw that. You know, so the acknowledgement of people, but The important part of the story was that at the following town hall meeting with all 700 staff, we called Kingsley onto the stage and told everyone about the idea that he had created and the impact it had made. And it was really life-changing for him because his attitude changed. He became much more enthusiastic about the menial tasks that were part of his job. And it was so cool to see, you know. And it was weird for me because when I left, he cried when I left. So, you know, like those things for me are just amazing around how recognition changes attitudinal behavior towards getting tasks done. And it's a small thing, but it was a big thing for him. You know, we try to encourage that certain staff members on each month could bring their child to work. Because as you are right now, your little boy or little girl, you are the hero. And if they could see what their hero does in a day, whether it be you working on a weed eater, painting the wall, whatever it was, those little kids went home and said, you know, my dad actually does this and this, and now I understand why he comes home late or whatever. It was so cool, you know. So I think recognition is something that we lack. And that's a failing in leadership sometimes, because a lot of leadership is around elevating yourself. I think it's important to employ people that are potentially better than you. The better people you have, the more you shine. And that's always been, you know, something that I've tried to do. Not always, but I've been employed by people that I think I was better than them, but I helped them be all better.
Yeah.
You know, so it's a slightly different philosophy. I think we live in a selfish world, you know.
Very much so, Dave. I mean, we talk about the mental capacity. So, you know, You're a mentor for a lot of people in the industry and in the game. But don't you think it's just by leadership? You know, you do what you say, and like you say, we don't always get it right. You know, I've got definitely more failures than success in my life. But it's about doing it. And I really interested in what you said there about that mental shift. It is a bit of a cliche saying, but it's that idea of I get to do something versus I have to do something.
Yeah.
And when it comes to the training and the pros, you know, it's that mindset, because I see it myself, and it's not, you know, at any particular, but, you know, PlayStation is just as important as the game of golf. You know, I just don't see the sacrifices that everybody's willing to make. And what they don't understand, you mentioned, you know, three or four major players like that, but the work that happens in the background. And I respect that craft massively. And I think then sponsorships, your confidence and all of that, it starts really with where you prepared to wake up in the morning at 6 o'clock when no one's cheering you on, no one's giving you a star on your forehead to say, we recognize this moment. It is your own discipline in what you do.
I think that's the reason why we've also started this podcast. I mean, we're not doing it for recognition, myself and Albert. We want to chat to guys like you and actually go into detail of the background, you know, all the meaningful stuff that's happening in the golf industry, the small, finer detail stuff. This is the important things that we want to speak about, and it's important.
Yeah.
You know, I don't, you know, money is just a
byproduct.
A byproduct of things. What impact have you made in life to people?
Yeah.
And that's the important thing for us, and that's why we're doing this.
You know, Dave, look at Michael, you know, your son. I don't know Adam. I've obviously heard of him. But for me, it's about you being that example of what he needs to do. But then also today, what do you need to do as a young man in order to make it in golf? You know, I asked Arthur and them as well. So it's great. You've now got a successful business fitting 5 years later. But that's boring to me almost. Hear me out. What did you do in the beginning? What steps did you have to take? What sacrifices did you have to do that's unavoidable to get you to the point of where you are now, successful? And now the first 5 years, and now what's the next 5 years looking like for TrueFit, which is very different to the first 5 years of building and establishing that brand. And it's the same thing for you, Dave. Like, you're involved in commentary in sport. Why are you still so relevant today in golf?
I think, I hope to think that I sort of take trouble to understand and learn a bit about the players.
Okay.
So when there is something going on, I have spoken to that guy, I know a little bit about him, and we take trouble to do that. But again, there's amazing leadership. There's a guy called Louis Hutton, who is the head of golf production. Yeah. He's an amazing guy. What he churns out for television in South Africa is world class.
Yeah.
I think it's better than anywhere else.
Stakes, yeah.
So, but his style of leadership and encouragement to do things that are a little bit outside the lines, but be relevant, you know. So we sometimes get away with saying certain things. Sometimes you don't. I mean,
like, what do you mean?
I think I could tell you a few stories inside doing commentary, you know, where I've had the very amazing privilege, obviously, with Dale Hayes as a massive mentor and influencer to me, but Sam Torrance and Ken Brown and Doogie Donnelly. So Sam Torrance and Dale Hayes are probably two of the naughtiest oaks you'll ever meet in your life. Okay, so there's always a story, and they've got many, many stories. So we had a thing at one stage where I had to say a word. I can't remember exactly the context of everything, but I had to say a word during my commentary. So now, when you realize that the Nedbank Golf Challenge is going out to 800 million people around the world, and South African humor is a little bit different to most, sometimes difficult to get the word in. And Robert Carlson helped me out, because my word for one particular day was robot. So how do you say robot in commentary? It's like very difficult. And Sam in particular, and Dale, used to give me a hard time on the mic internally in my ear. And Robert Carlson on the 14th, the par 5 little dogleg to the right, gets up on the tee and he double crosses his tee shot and it goes in the bush. And that year the bush was really thick. And I was running there and got there, and Dale or Sam said to me with a, you know, a little tongue in cheek, "So Dave, what happened to that shot?" And it was perfect timing for me, because I said he double crossed the tee shot, hit the cart path, and went like a taxi through a red robot. So robot was out. I got my word done, you know, but I got into trouble for that. But you know, those kinds of things where there's a lot of little private jokes in the background, especially when Dale's around and Sam to a certain degree. And then, you know, like you listen to guys like Ken Brown, who played Ryder Cup multiple, went on the DP World Tour, just an amazing man. So the things that you have the ability to learn from those guys is wonderful. Just to sort of jump ahead a little bit, I went to the Open recently with my son Michael, and on the Saturday night, one of the guys in our group had arranged for us to go in a van, and we went off to this farmhouse, and it was on the Saturday night of the Open. And we got there, there was just eight of us, and there was a man waiting to welcome us into his home. It was Gary Player.
No way.
So we went into this house, and there was a table for eight people. No, Gary,
when you
Player's
went there,
a couple of weeks ago. And Mr. Player was sitting at the head of the table, and we all sat down, and we had the most amazing time because, and I mean this with the greatest respect to Mr. Player, he's got sort of two personas. One is the media and all that stuff, but he's just an amazing man as a human being and what he's doing, and he's highlighting health, and obviously he always gives me a bit of a go because I'm portly, but it's always in good faith, you know. So to have that opportunity to do that. But I will tell you another story about Mr. Player, if you will indulge me for a second. I went to the senior tour school. So we go and play at Royal Johannesburg in Kensington, because I still fancy myself a little bit to have a game.
I've played with you before, I would say that.
To the Farmers Weekly on a Wednesday anyway. So I'm playing with my dear friend Paul Marks, and there's only 10 cards available, and we're both in the mix, and we've got a couple of holes to go. And I hit it to on the 11th hole, that par 4 down the hill, and green sloping back towards you. And I hit a reasonably good shot, but a little long, and I've got 15 foot downhill. But I think that bikini waxed the greens that day, so I'm like a hell of a nervous on this little downhiller. And I hit it, and I just showed too much respect, and the thing comes up about 3 foot short, 4 foot short. So I'm even mark the ball, and I stand there, I'm going like, and in my mind, I'm going through a chaos. My mind's going, these wheel spins. So I think, I don't want to hit this too hard, but don't hit it too. Oh no, I hit it a little bit hard, catches the lip, and spins out to another 4 foot. So now I'm scrambled. And now everyone's waiting for me because I'm the only Muppet putting. I putt the last one up. I just flat up yip it, goes next to the hole, tap it in for four putts. So I don't say anything. I walk into the next tee, and Paul says to me, "Dave, what happened to you there?" So I said, "No, Paul, it felt like I had a taser gun in my pocket, you know, it was like crazy, I was like jumpy." Anyway, we finished the round, and fortunately I managed to get my card and everything's cool. So I've given away half the story already, but a few months later I'm at home and then my phone rings, and it's a number I don't recognize. "Hello? Dave, Gary Player." "Geez, Mr. Player, how are you? Wow, wow, wow." Exchange pleasantries. He said, "Listen, my boy, I've got an entourage of press out here from the US. And we're doing, my new book is going to be my 18 favorite holes in South Africa. And I've done most of them, but I'm stuck on the 11th hole at Royal Johannesburg in Kensington." So, "Well, Mr. Player, you know, I don't have a story for you right off the top of my head, but if I plow my mind, I'll think of something, I'll do some homework, and I'll come back to you with a cool story about the 11th. So there's a pause, and he goes, "Didn't you hear about that prick whose taser gun went off in his pocket?" And I hear Paul Marks giggling in the background, and I think, you know, it's crazy. That's what I love about golf, that could happen, you know, to just like a little me, and he has Mr. Player, he's in and he's got a joke. And that's a side that people don't know, you know. So the privilege of having that opportunity with Mr. Player was crazy. But, you know, my son Michael, he was Gary Todd. He's a wonderful guy. He works on the tour. He's a tournament director and very knowledgeable rules official. In fact, he's gone to the President's Cup and he's done Ryder Cups, and he regularly travels around the world. He's highly respected. So Michael was asking him about a ruling. So I said, "Look, there's my phone there. Just get Gary Todd's number because he knows a lot about rules. People think I know the rules. I know nothing." So anyway, he gets the phone and he goes, "Dad, you got Gary Player's number here." So I said, "Well, just don't worry about Gary Player's number. Phone Gary Todd." So obviously he takes the number. So now he's studying. He's doing very well in his PGA program to become a professional. And he did a whole lot of, there were a couple of chapters in something he had to do about Gary Player. So he, you know, I was cross with him, but he took the number and he sent Gary Player a WhatsApp. "You know, Mr. Player, I'm reading all this about you. I'd love to have a coffee with you one day," or whatever. So he's lying on the bed and him and his girlfriend are chatting about something. And the next thing, the phone rings. And she's taking photographs of the phone ringing because it's Gary Player's phoning him. So Gary Player spoke to him for 20 minutes on the phone about his career and stuff that helped him get a bit of insight in terms of the preparation for his assignment. So those are things that people don't know, you know.
Yeah, and taking the time to do so.
Just an amazing man, you know. And I think I mean, Gary is, I think he'll be 87 in November, the first his birthday, okay? 87 years old. That guy is so fit. And he was telling us that they're probably going to do a documentary of what you can do as an 87-year-old if you look after yourself.
Yeah.
I don't think I'll make 87. But, I mean, just an amazing inspiration to people. And everywhere he goes. So that's a cool example. So you talk about examples and things that motivate you. Because when you go back to your story about waking up in the morning and go to gym and all that, there's sacrifice that involved. But there needs to be a reason to do that. So what is the goal? So a lot of guys go, you know, you win a couple of things at your club and they say turn pro and then the guy's playing pro and he's got no clue what it's about. You go to tour school and you get your tour card. What a tour card means is they're giving you the opportunity to spend 500 grand a year trying to do this. That's all. It doesn't mean nothing. It doesn't mean you're going to be successful. It doesn't mean anything. So when you, and then the other thing is sometimes you'll hear, you know, like Dylan now, we were talking about Dylan Mostert earlier, lovely, lovely young man, grafts, a hard working, taken the opportunities that have been given to him, and he's making something of it. But he's making it because he works hard. He practices. He's focused on what he wants to do. So when you are like that, there needs to be something that initiates that desire to do it. It doesn't happen for everybody. But when you talk about success, recent success stories in South Africa, you take Christian Besaidenhout. Okay, Christian Besaidenhout obviously has a speech impediment that has worked in his favor. I think once he overcame the psychological element of that, it's worked in his favor because he found a way to just grind it out. Mo Norman is a wonderful story. He was a man. He was born in the early 1920s.
Who's Mo Norman?
He's a Canadian golfer.
Okay. He's very well known for one plane swing.
Yes. So Mo Norman was born in the 20s, and I think in 1925, 92, somewhere around there, a car drove over him. But because there was no blood and everybody wasn't really aware, and it was obviously a long time ago, they thought he was fine, but he wasn't fine. And he grew up with a problem. And he wasn't comfortable to talk to people. And he was a little bit of a, you know, nowadays he would be an outcast because kids are brutal.
Brutal, yeah.
So he was an outcast. But he found solace in playing golf. And that I could hit balls. He would hit a pole from 200 yards. He wouldn't hit it once. He'd hit it 5-6 times. To the point where a lot of the tour players, guys like Fred Couples and Vijay Singh, they would go and watch Mo Norman hit balls. And Mo Norman is the most awkward, but he worked it out what worked for him. And that was amazing that he found a way to find his little place in the world.
On that, Arthur and Dave, it's something I wanted to ask. So you were saying it's the one plane swing that he was focusing on. If you don't mind me just jumping into the swing a bit. So the PGA obviously has a swing routine that they coach and train on. I'm right in saying that.
Yep.
But there's challenges that comes to that swing. What I mean challenges, there's coaches challenging that swing at the moment. You know, let's say the traditional golf swing. As long as the ball gets made contact with, however you get there, as long as it has a certain path in which the ball gets made contact on. We deal with a lot with performance academies. And at the moment, one of the big things is shoulder rotation and how it's supposed to dip or not dip. But just tell me about the swing and the coaching part of it, if you don't mind. I'm a young golfer today, or I'm a professional in the field. Do you think it's good to be coached in a particular swing that's traditionally worked for other successful players? Or do you think it's like a Bubba Watson approach? Eric Van Rooyen that wasn't coached, you know, for a very long time in his life where they work these things out. What's your view on that? If I've summarized it in the right way.
Well, let's just go to the first part of the question. From a PGA qualification point of view, there's a curriculum that you have to go through and you pass it and everything. So when I go and study to be a doctor, I go through the same thing. The heart belongs here and the brain's here and whatever. I need to know that stuff. Then I branch off and I start doing other things and I become a specialist in various areas. I did that. I did all that stuff and I learned how to be a coach. I mean, a lot of people are still looking for their money back. But anyway, so there's coaching is a multitude of things. It's knowledge, the knowledge to impart onto the individuals that you're with. But more importantly, to understand that person's limitations, their expectations. Because a 20 handicap comes to you and says, I want to be a scratch. This is a long story. This is going to take us a long time. And this is a process. And we need to go through all of these things. But fundamentally, the grip and the stance and alignment, those things have to be right.
Yeah.
Right now, if you look at some of the players, successful players on the tour, Matthew Wolf.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, he's got a crazy swing.
Crazy swings. Yeah.
I mean, there's a couple other guys.
Yeah.
So there's a whole lot of different permutations. Scottie Scheffler, number one in the world.
Yeah.
No. He looks like Fred Astaire through the ball.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it works for him. So it's about being adaptable. And I think over time, if we went back 50, 60 years ago, what was in the manual was the only thing that worked. Then David Ledbetter came along.
Yeah.
And David Ledbetter, in my humble opinion, one of the better teachers in the world, but one of the best marketing people in the world.
Mm.
So Dennis Watson won, I think, two or three times. I think it was two or three weeks in a row won, and people went, what happened to this guy? He goes to Ledbetter. Everyone went to Ledbetter. Then Ledbetter came out with little drills and training aids. And I mean, you could look like, you know, you're in a straitjacket by the time you finished all that stuff. And it was relevant to what he was doing with Watson. It wasn't relevant to you and me, but would we aspire to being like that? So the golf, the tour drives the industry. If you look at a new driver comes out, people go stand in queues at golf shops and buy that with no, it's like buying bread and milk. You know, they've got no clue how this thing works and what it does. I mean, I can drive, you can drive, but I can't drive Hamilton's car. I'll have a crash.
No, we hear it all the time, Dave. I mean, I quite literally from the big retailers in South Africa, people come in and say, I want the Bryson driver.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, from a sales perspective, they don't argue that too much, you know. Happy to provide you with the Bryson. But, you know, it leads me sort of into that traditionally, it's about having a swing. What I see more and more in golf now is that people don't understand the physicality that goes behind training to get to that speed and process. It's a team of 10. One stretches him. One just focuses on his legs and his arm. One is good in rotation. He works on all sorts of different equipment. He equips a gym that probably costs hundreds of thousands of dollars to put together to get to the point where he can drive the way he does or swing perhaps the way he does with the accuracy that he does. But do you see golf in the three arms that we see it moving towards, which is the swing, is one capacity. Because the skill of the swing, to me, is everywhere. I see skills in swings. People can shape things. But then the mental capacity is what doesn't pull them through. And then the third arm, which I see, if you look at Andrew McKenna in Silver Lakes as an example, the motion, body motion fitness that goes to accommodate those ambitions you have through your swing. Do you see that those arms, or am I just naive to it that it's always been part of the golf thinking?
No, I think it is very relative. But you've got to start with a product, okay? So you're a relatively fit guy in good shape. So I'm 10 years older than you, whatever it is. I'm not in great shape, blah, blah, blah. So my flexibility will be very different to yours. I think the number one thing is to be able to sit and evaluate the person, what their expectations are, and then work on a plan.
Okay.
So
customizing
the good teachers, guy like Steve Cottingham at Mount Edgecombe, or my dear friend John Dixon, who arguably is the best teacher I know, because he never tells the same story to anybody.
Mm.
He adapts your ability and then ties it in with your expectations. So if you're currently slightly overweight, not very flexible, and you're 12 handicap and you want to be a scratch, you got to go deal with those three things. You physically, you need to get better, you need to get flexible, and you need to have a better understanding of the fundamentals of your swing. And John would do that with you, as would Steve, and there's a couple of other coaches, which Wayne Bradley done in the Cape. So the overall package is right. Some people can afford to have that entourage, others can't. And then, but when you sign up for a lesson, so a lot of the lessons that I did in my life, and I'm sure, Arthur, you go, the guy's just coming to get a little bit of a jab of enthusiasm. Yeah, you're looking good today. Well done, great shot. He's never going to go practice the things you've told him to do. Never. And then next week he plays badly again, then he comes for another lesson. He's actually wasting his time and your money, or his money and your time.
Yeah.
So you have that guy. But then you have the people that want to progress. So the professionals have got that entourage because they realize the importance of each of those things. Some might even have a putting coach, a chipping coach, all different things. But sometimes it can be a little bit of overkill. So when you go back, I've done the most cool experience for myself. Along with a friend of mine, Mark Colley, we got a whole lot of questions, okay? And we asked a whole lot of players the same questions and try to extract the common denominator out of those questions. When you talk about the evolution of their game, and these are older players, Georgie Kutsia, I guess only 35 years old, but he's been around for a while. Sean Norris, very successful guy. Those kind of guys that have been around for a little while. And then you extract the common denominators. None of it is about swing. George Kutsia, I love George to death. But George Swing is not going to be in any manuals, I can promise you. But he knows how to do it, and he knows what he's working on, and he's a highly intelligent person. Sean Norris was so interesting for me because Sean, he doesn't chip the ball very well.
Mm.
Okay. But when he was young and starting out and he couldn't chip very well, it became a problem for him. Now he putts from way off the green. In at Stain City, when he won on the DP World Tour, he putted a couple of times from 40 meters out.
Mm.
And he got up and down. Now, another guy would have done that with a wedge. He doesn't care anymore what people think about him because the initial stages of being a pro must impress everybody.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I've a 40-foot putt shots. Isn't necessarily yeah. the most impressive
he's
shot.
Past, yeah. He's gone past that point of
yeah.
image.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's the evolution of a guy like that. So if you can take some of these younger guys and say, listen, yeah, let me fast-track your career by 3 or 4 years, by instead of you smashing your head against the wall, I'm going to give you a shortcut. And the shortcut is based on experienced players, what they've done, why they've done it. So going back to Sean said, you know, I don't chip well, but he's learned how to get away with it. Sean was an amazing, amazing amateur. I think at one stage he was a +9 handicap. Massive expectations about how he was going to take on the world. He couldn't do it. He couldn't achieve it. So what he did, under the radar, he went off to Japan. He's become a legend in Japan because he was away from the expectations and pressures that were keeping him back. Other players thrive on that. So going back to the personalities and the three factors you're talking about, the mental side of it is it encompasses so many things. How do I feel this morning? What am I going to do today? And sacrifice is a massive thing. So you know that iceberg where you see all the success on the top, yeah. but underneath is the sacrifice, the pain, hours, the yeah. pain, the suffering, the blah, blah, blah. Those things are important. There's no overnight success. There's no way they say, oh, this guy's overnight. No. This kid who won the British amateur,
yeah.
Aldrich Potgieter,
yeah.
overnight success. Nonsense.
No, it's nonsense.
That guy was grafting since he's 10, 11, 12.
Yeah.
Every day, same thing, blah, 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 blah. And now he's won. Okay, overnight. No, the guy's grafting. This kid, Christian Moss, plays out of Pretoria Country Club. He gets coached at Silver Lakes by Nico van Rensburg.
Nico's birthday was yesterday.
Yeah, yes. Indeed. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. So, was it getting old? But Christian is... This guy is phenomenal for me. He's rounded. Funny enough, I met his father for the first time last night, Chris Devon.
Yeah, I've met him. Yeah.
Lovely man, dentist. Mm. So he's fundamentally, he's a well-mannered, well-brought-up, respectful, conscious of a lot of things, grateful for his life, hardworking, made sacrifices. He's all these words that we throw around all the time. He's all of those, okay? He just started this week at Texas University.
Yeah.
Okay, he's 4 days there, and then he's going to represent South Africa in the Eisenhower Trophy.
Yep,
this guy can play. I was very fortunate to get a bet through a friend of mine in London that he will win a major. I took the bet when he was 16.
No.
I put R1,000 on and R1,000 to 1.
Okay, I was just going to say, what's your ratio? 1,000 to 1.
1,000
okay.
to 1.
I think you're pretty safe there, Dave.
So it's going to happen. But it's because of all those things. So it goes back to his swing, amazing. Athletic, yes. Strong, big, blah, blah, blah. But when you look at what happened in that final, I mean, the final, he's caddying for his mate. He misses out the final. Yeah. He has a kid who's the number one.
And Rand Park, don't forget Rand Park. Christian was won the, he was the amateur winner at the Rand Park Open, man.
SA Open.
Oh, SA Open. Yeah, my apologies. SA Open.
But to finish my point, quite important. Here's a guy, number one amateur in South Africa. He's caddying for his buddy in the final of the British Amateur Championship. And he's telling his buddy things that he needs to apply to himself.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
slowing him down, getting him sort of keeping him in the process. So I think, you know, when you watch that, it says a lot about who he is and what kind of person he is. How did he get there?
Yes.
Then you meet his dad, amazing guy. Love to meet his mother.
So humble.
So you look at all these blocks. It's so relevant and it's so tough. When we talk about some of the younger players that we're also trying to help, that don't come from that background, that don't come from positive influence, that don't come from positive style of living, how do you bridge that gap? And that's quite a hard thing. You know, so to go back to those three fundamental pillars of golf growth. They're right, but they're not right. And there's a multitude of other things. So, you know, when we look at golf, I suppose it's like every sport. You can't put everyone in a box and say, this is how it works. It doesn't work like that. And each person has to be, you have to have a little bit of thought. There needs to be openness and negotiation. Yeah. Because when you're talking to somebody, a lot of people don't want to talk about what they can't do.
Yeah.
So I can't touch my toes. Okay, that's fine. Okay, so you can't touch your toes. Let's work on that. It's going to take us 3 months to get you to touch your toes, but it's a part of flexible, whatever. I'm just a silly example, but it's important.
I hear you. Because in sport, you know, if you look at Wimbledon tennis championships or whether it be in cricket, it's not like they have all exactly the same. So I want to, you know, I want a cricket, you know, I'm a World Cup rugby cricket winner or captain, but you can also win with another captain. That style is completely different. So I like what you're saying there about making sure that you individualize and take all of that into consideration. But I feel, do you feel, and this is a question to both you and Arthur, you've got the era of Ernie Els, the Goose, and it feels like we've skipped. Who's the next, and what separates? Why did they make it so big in golf? What was the difference? Why did the guys? So at the moment in South Africa, I think our golf has never been alive. Not too long ago, I think it was a year and a half ago, we were top 10 of the top 100 field as the top one player. But it doesn't feel like our conversion is the same. Or am I wrong?
No, I'd kind of disagree with you on one or two points, but let's just go back to why those guys were good, because they worked harder than anybody else. Mm.
Okay.
That's it.
Okay.
They're talented. Yep. There was a many guys talented. At that same time, Nico van Rensburg was winning in Asia. Mm. Des de Blanche was winning. There were a lot of players, but they didn't elevate to that level. Trevor Immelman was the next one.
Yep.
High work intensity, amazing guy. And we've seen the rest of his career. So, but at the same time, the rest of the world is progressing.
Correct.
So you look at the Asian tours and all these other tours and the satellite tours. These are seriously good players. As South Africans, we expect our guys to win all the time.
Okay.
You used cricket a moment ago. Let's take Graham Smith. Graham Smith, arguably one of the best captains. Arguably one of the best batsmen. Definitely one of the best opening batsmen we ever had. Technique, terrible.
Mm.
Guts, unbelievable. So Dean Elgar, similar. So I was chatting to Dean recently, and I said to him, you know, I really admire your guts. Because he gets hit with the ball. I'd be in tears half the time. He got hit like that. He carries on and he grinds. He said, Dave, I haven't got guts. I'm hungry. So I thought about that for a little bit. And he's hungry to be successful. He's driven. He's sacrificing. He's grafting. He knows his technique's not great. But he performs a role within his ability.
Yeah.
And it goes back to what I was saying about Norris earlier. Norris doesn't care if people think he can't chip. He's the guy that's standing with a trophy.
Yeah. Mm.
So, and it's the same as Elgar. Elgar hasn't got these classic shots. He's not a David Gawa. He's an amazing, gritty player that gets done with what he has. So, and there's been a few players like that, you know. So guys who, take Darren Fickard. Darren Fickard, a wonderful guy. Darren's in his 40s now. He's still competing at top level. He hasn't got a classic swing by any stretch of the imagination. But he knows what he's doing. And he works hard. He works exceptionally hard. And that's what I think the message is for a lot of young guys. If you want to play, I say to a kid, you know, I said a little guy, and I said to him, tell me something. What does your dad do? He says, no, my dad's a doctor. I said, wow, that's amazing. So does he go to work at like 10 o'clock in the morning, come home for lunch, and then have a sleep, and then watch a movie, and then go and fix it? No. Does he do that? No. My dad goes to work at 6 o'clock, comes home sometimes at 8 o'clock. So that's cool. So you've got a good example to you, but you start working at 10. And then you work for a little bit, and you have the afternoon off, and then is that how it works? No, I didn't ever think of it like that. So your example of hard work is not necessarily only around sport.
Yeah.
Everybody, you've worked hard. You've worked hard to build your career. Whoever, you're grafting all the time. So as an example to be relevant there. Again, for some of these youngsters, I think life is too easy. We spoil our children. I do. You do.
Stacey Brechman is one of the hardest working ladies also on the tour. She's incredibly disciplined at what she does.
She's strong and she's gymless and she works
hard. Look at J.B. Kruger.
Yeah.
I mean, he's this big.
Yeah.
He's got the most unorthodox swing, but he knows his game.
Yeah.
You know, he gets it in the hole. It's not pretty watching him, but he knows his own game. He's not long, but he gets it done.
But it's inspirational.
Correct.
Massively, yeah.
He's always got a smile on his face. Let's talk about ladies golf for a second, because, I mean, check it, Ashley Wynn. So right. Ashley, 12 or 13, I think she won the ladies club championship at the Royal Johannesburg in Kensington. So there's a lot of pressure on her to be, and she retained a relatively level head, and she's been relatively successful. You know, but it was, I think I, for one, was so... I was quite emotional watching her win because I knew her story.
I don't even know when I got emotional about it.
And she
was known as Ashley Simon when she was growing up.
Yeah.
She obviously got married.
Okay, yes.
And now
yes.
She's Boo High. But I think she was also the youngest woman SA ladies Open Championship.
Everything.
She won everything. She was big as a kid.
But now that's come about and she's won, and she's also made relative money, because I think her prize money was like 18 million rand. So that is relevant to everything else. And we're seeing that trend where the sports are getting closer together, which is cool. I think everyone deserves that. I suppose the marketability of men's golf to a certain degree has become a bit cloudy with this new tour and with new things, and it's not necessarily projecting the right image of golf as a gentleman's game and all those really cool things that we like to promote golf as. It's now become, there's a bit of a dogfight out there, and that's unfortunate, the marketing side and egos and all those kinds of things. But at the end of the day, the guys who are pitching up to tee it up, they're still representing the sport in a good way. They're well-dressed, well-mannered, play by the rules. It's cool. I mean, where in which sport? I loved at the Open now, we went to Turnberry and played Turnberry, which was an amazing experience because I'd been to the Open there many years ago with my dad when Nick Price won. And we went into the clubhouse there and we were having a real cool time. And there's a bar called, the restaurant is called the Jewel in the Sun. And the Jewel in the Sun is all relevant back to 1977 when Nicklaus was playing with Watson. And they came to the last hole and Watson was leading by one. And Watson, Nicklaus, hit his tee shot in the rough, and Watson split the fairway. Watson then followed that up with an 8-iron to about 3 foot. So Nicklaus muscled it out and got it to the edge of the green, and the crowd went crazy, and Nicklaus got over the putt, and Watson said to his caddy, he's going to make this, and he made it. And the place erupted. It was this crazy noise, and it was going mad, and Watson realized he needed to still make this 3 foot, and he was nervous as hell. And he walked forward and he placed his ball, and the crowd was making a noise, and Nicklaus walked into the middle of the green and raised his arms, and the place went silent. And he knocked the putts and he won the Open. There's no other sport that will happen.
Mm.
We see players high-fiving. We saw McIlroy at the Open hold a crazy bunker shot on 10. The place erupted. He walked up onto the tee. Most of those holes are close to one another. Scottie Scheffler gave him a high-five. The caddies gave him a high-five. Where do you see that in other sport? And those are the things that we need to retain. So you have a sport that represents so many good things. And we've spoken about charity. We've spoken about meeting people. I mean, I played golf with Mr. F.W. de Klerk. Yeah. I had lunch with Mr. Mandela because of golf. I've played with plumbers and lawyers and whatever, and fancy pants and all these things. And there's probably, not even on my one hand, can I tell you of five guys I would never want to play golf with again.
Yeah.
But 40 kilograms ago, I played football, and I probably wouldn't want to have dinner with any of those guys ever again in my life. So it's a totally different, it's an amazing sport.
But don't you think sport has that history with South Africa? That South African in sport has always been a phenomenal vehicle to move us as a nation forward, to bring us together as a nation.
Mm.
And Dave, I'm 40 years old now, so I'm certainly not a youngster. But I appreciate that there's been some changes in golf. You know, when I joined Bryanston as a member quite some time ago, the club has entirely changed. It wasn't a very conducive environment necessarily as a youngster to be in that environment when we were younger. But the game has developed. And if you look at some of the larger CEOs and successful people, this one is a fun CEO. So he likes to have fun. But he's still just as successful as the next CEO that's serious and, don't want to walk. There's no difference between the two. They got to the same point. They might have completely different personalities. And I like the idea that in golf at the moment, there's a bit more openness about that. If you look at the tour that we just saw, challenging tour at the moment, or the Lift Tour, that social side that came out at the one event, people would say, those are all real good people that just had a great time. And there happened to be this exciting energy that all of us feed from. So I really encourage people to say, yes, there's certain common things that in golf we appreciate. And it's the same in business. It's discipline, accountability. You have to see things through. Make sure your word of mouth is what you say it is. It's the same thing in business, but it doesn't mean you can't have fun. It doesn't mean we can't chirp our mates, And I think we should do that a lot more, because there's that part of that if you look at sponsorships as well, what attracts a sponsorship? It's not this cocky attitude. It's not this I'm better than anybody else. It is a humble approach with a good heart and with good intent. And that's what the sponsorships or sponsors really want to be associated with. It's not always. So I think it's all each to their own. And I like what you said about carving out your own journey. You know, Arthur fits a certain way. Arthur runs his business a certain way. But there's also other guys that do it completely the opposite way and doesn't necessarily move away from the fundamentals of success, but they're still successful at what they do. So I always encourage our team here that I think this is the way you should do it. But there's people that will get to the exact same result, but just in a completely different way. Rather encourage that than trying to say, if you don't do it this way, you won't be successful at what you do.
I agree with that 100%. I mean, if you take footing, I was very fortunate to go to Golfsmith back in the day, and I went to the Harvey Penick Academy. And at the time, I think Golfsmith was the biggest component company in the world, and I went to the training, and fundamentally, the training is pretty much the same as your training, but you take your own little nuances, your own understanding of certain things, and then you combine your knowledge about stuff. So you've got fitting a club needs a shaft and a grip and a head, and there's a few things you can bend and change. But when you start to understand the person and the dynamics of what they can and can't do, you can make such a significant difference to their game. I mean, I'm so very fortunate to be sponsored by Shricks and Golf. And I remember I was the director of golf at Centurion in the early, mid-90s. And Mark Powell he worked for Titleist in those days, and he was the rep, and he came in and one day said, "Guys, I'm leaving Titleist." I said, "What are you going to do? Are you joking?" So he said, "No, I'm going to go to Shrickson." So I said, "Shrickson, is that like a fish and chip shop? What is this place?" He said, "No, it's this new ball." Anyway, he's now the president of Shrickson, and I was very fortunate to have a drink with him recently. He was in South Africa for a couple of days, and I've gone on to see how that brand has evolved and what they've done. And that was a clear picture of, firstly, the product. They make a great product. You can't find bad equipment anymore. They make a great product. They've got great brands. Their culture as a Japanese company is such an amazing culture. And I think that is part of where their success lies. Over time, they've built better and better equipment. And that goes for Ping. I mean, I was fortunate to meet Carsten Solheim at Ping, also in the early 90s. Amazing experience. Spent the day with him. We went to his own golf club called Moon Valley. We went in the safe where all the gold putters are. I played with Ping for a long time. Brilliant stuff, you know. But the tour drives the industry. Because if I like Brooks Koepka, I might be much more inclined to use Shrickson than use Titleist. Mm-hmm. But if I like Justin Thomas, I'm going to be more inclined to use That's why they spend all that money on those players, because the tour drives the industry. But getting back to fitting and the importance of fitting and the bedside manner, sometimes it's not what I say, it's what the person hears.
Mm-hmm.
But if I back it up with the knowledge that you have and the sort of the bedside manner around understanding that person, because we did an experiment. We spoke a little bit earlier about option golf back in the day. So there was a golf show here at our Nando Bowling or Polo Club. So you get these Rambo guys arriving and you say, "So what do you normally, how far do you hit your 7-iron?" "No, 170. "Okay, cool. And your driver?" "No, I hit my driver 300. "So like, so let's see." And then the guy hits the driver underground, along the ground, but it goes 300. Then what happens is we start giving them, we had all the shafts unbranded and no branding on the head. "So try this." The guy goes, "I usually use a 9-degree extra stiff." Hits it, yeah, underground. Then he hit this. Eventually, the guy's hitting these beautiful, beautiful shots, flatted, lovely. He goes, "Oh, this is nice. Well, that's a senior shaft with a 12-degree head." "No, I'm not using that." No. So we all suffer from that Rambo syndrome.
Yeah, yeah,
the
yeah.
Rambo syndrome is a hard thing to get past. Yes. So when you're fitting, you know, what is your starting point in terms of fitting people?
I think it's, first of all, getting to know the customer. What he's there for. But for me, it's about giving the consumer the knowledge, the correct info. You know, I don't want to lie to my customer. If he wants an extra stiff and he needs a regular, I'll say, "Okay, I'm not going to fit you because you need this particular profile of club because you fit this profile." So for me, honesty is huge, you know. And if he doesn't want the 9-degree extra stiff or the 12-degree senior shaft, then I'm not going to sell it to him. So it's more about honesty for me and getting through to the customer and educating. I think educating is key. A lot of the guys just see stuff on TV and "I want this because he's playing with it."
Yeah.
10-1, they're not even using the same stuff you get off the shelf.
Yeah,
you know, they've got the prototype or the tour head. So it's just about honesty at the end of the day.
But Arthur, both for yourself and Dave, you know, that is the starting block. But what makes you sustainable, yourself and somebody like Dave, is you've pulled it through.
Mm.
There's been results on the fitting that you've done. So therefore, the customer feels it was a purpose-driven exercise.
Mm-hmm.
The same thing with you, Dave. When you see young players and you take the time to say, I'm actually going to challenge this guy about his thinking there. Or I'm actually going to speak to this guy and hopefully... The fact is that what you said had impact. Impact then showed onto the player, which then showed onto the course, showed with better growth, more sponsorships, whatever that determination is. That's why you have credibility. It's very easy to speak about how I'm going to do it, but it's far more difficult to pull it through to a place where what you said there in the beginning and how you want to approach it, that actually allows you to have credibility at the end of it. And that's something that I I'm also still learning as a young man to take on. Dave, and you I just wanted to ask you, the golf, what do you think is the next big push in golf? And why do you think it's so alive at the moment?
Well, yeah, it's quite a cool question, because I think through the pandemic that everyone was exposed to, a lot of people came back to golf because they couldn't play other sports. A lot of young people, school-going children and everything, started playing golf because they couldn't play other sports. So that was an immediate impact. Then what happened, I think a vast majority of these people realized that it's actually a cool game. Because when I was a kid at school, it wasn't cool to play golf. You know, you had to play rugby or soccer or cricket or whatever. But
that's a fair point. I didn't think about it that way before.
So that became pretty cool. And then I suppose the television exposure has been so consistent and so powerful and so
much better,
sexy, that people want to be part of that, you know. So we talk about, you know, traditional stuff, obviously the PGA Tour and the DP World Tour, the Asian Tour to a lesser degree. The women's golf is becoming much more prominent. Women's sport is becoming much more prominent. So a lot of younger girls, young ladies are wanting to, they see the value of playing golf. And then, of course, then you've got this disruptor being Live Golf, which is now sexied up golf. It's acknowledging different things. It's a different format. It's also had
a great impact on global golf in 100%. Its entirety.
So I think the exposure of golf, particularly over the last few years, has been that much more significant. If you take the Open this year, it was the 150th Open, 150 years of doing this.
Yeah.
So it gave it a special feel, and it was so brilliant to be there. But there's a different excitement around golf, you know. And then you look at the people that are promoting and playing the game. I think you mentioned a little earlier, you know, a lot of guys were quiet, they stayed in their own lane, they didn't do stuff. Now golfers are challenging. There's some guys who talk very well, others don't. There's different shots, there's different swings, the marketing around lessons, the importance of fitting, the product that's coming out there is consistently better from all the manufacturers. People are playing better. So I think it's a combination of all of those things. There's not one particular thing. But it needs to keep moving, you know, because other sports are also changing their attitude to things. We spoke at various points over time on different platforms around what golf could become. Because, you know, time is becoming a problem. We're having Serengeti have got a really successful little thing. Every other Friday they play four holes at 4 o'clock with four clubs, and guys go along with their children and they play. And it's an introduction to golf, but it's fun. It's not 18 holes for a 10-year-old is hard because, you know, and the holes are long. And
you lose attention.
Yeah, over time we changed. And I was quite proud of the fact that I was involved with starting SA Kids Golf. We started in the beginning as littlekidsgolf.co.za with a guy called Alan Burke and a guy called Brian Ruloffs, who's a teaching professional most of his life. And we started a thing where we made tees for six-year-old boys, six-year-old girls, 7 years, 8 years, so on. So they could, and a par four was 80 meters. They could do that because they saw that on television. It was pointless having a hole that was a million miles away. They give up.
Yeah.
You know, so, how that came about was I was playing with my young son, Adam. He was six at the time. Played a Wild Coast, and I gave him, so if it was a par four, I made a par seven. Because he, playing games, he had worked out what par was. So he understood par. He didn't know about the distance. So he could make a six and be one under par. And he was quite excited about playing golf because his reference point was the tour where he saw red numbers all the time. He couldn't make red numbers even off the ladies' tees, even off from the front of the fairway. But because we changed the par, his reference point became relevant for him.
Mm.
And I think that's what's happened. So a lot of golf, Jeff Claus at St. Francis Links, unbelievable, they've got a par three course, they've got junior tees, they've got all these different permutations that gives everybody the opportunity. And I wish more clubs were open-minded around being conscious of the importance of making changes, making the course a little easier. You know, I don't want to go and play and play really and shoot 85. I don't want to do that. And what is my best fun? I played last week and there was a tribute to Peter Matkovich, one of the greatest human beings, as I mentioned earlier. That's a real legend. I mean, all the beautiful golf courses he built. But one of them is Zimbiti, which is a 13-hole par 3. 13 of the holes are par 3s, 3 par 4s and a par 5. And none of that, it's not a mashy course. Listen, you can get found out there's a little bit as well. There's some tough shots. There's some easy. There's some that look easy, but they aren't that easy. It's a great challenge, and it's a par 60. And as opposed to 4 hours, it probably takes 3 hours.
Yeah.
And you can play 9 holes in an hour and 15 minutes. And it's changed the dynamics of that club. There's a vibe afterwards. People come down, have a beer, play a few holes. So I think that's what we have to be aware of. You know, the traditionalists, that's fine. I'm one of them.
Yeah.
I'm trying to be relevant in my thoughts all the time around the future of golf. So I can see that in time, golf will be 6 holes or 12 holes, like it used to be in the beginning. The first Open in 1860 was played over 12 holes, just did it 3 times.
Yeah.
So you can have permutations that work. There's designs where there's 6 holes, back to the clubhouse, 6 holes, back to the clubhouse, 6 holes. So you can do that. So I think that's what will happen. I think we'll see more speed golf, more fun golf. The LIV Tour is going to challenge some of those traditional things. I don't, you know, whether it's 4 rounds, 3 rounds, 2 rounds, it is what it is, you know.
Yeah.
And it does appeal to people. But let's not disregard people who like that.
Yeah.
I love my greatest thing is to watch the Masters or the Open or whatever it is and sit there and go through every shot and watch it. It excites me. But I can imagine it's not for everybody.
Yeah.
So a lot of people can pop in, watch live, see what's happening in all the holes because everyone's playing, see more people.
And YouTube made it accessible to the youngsters. You know?
Absolutely. So that's what it is. Unfortunately, there's the egos and money that's you know, making it a little bit muddy. But we've got to be careful that that doesn't happen too long that people get confused and go do something else.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's, the sport is driven so much by what we see on television. You know, if you watch the fill-in guy on the PGA Tour, they've got this guy, I don't know, he's probably the worst commentator I've ever heard in my life. He tells you what it is, but they use this guy all the time. So I can imagine, everyone I speak to says, where does that come from? There must be thousands of people who could
that
do that.
They can do that, yeah.
And they've got this guy, whatever his deal is, and shame, I'm not trying to badmouth him, but he doesn't add excitement to the tour.
Yeah.
When you listen to Sam Torrance,
yeah, it's completely different.
That's a different. Or Johnson, Tony Even Johnson. Even
Trevor's
fantastic.
Fantastic, yeah.
And his brother Mark, when he talks on the range and the technicalities, that's what people want to know.
Mm.
You asked in the top of the show about, you know, the young players in South Africa. For me, it's important that I go and find out who they are, what they do. It's nice for me because you need to be relevant when you're talking about somebody. So we've used that word relevant a lot. And I think disruption and relevant go hand in hand in terms of the potential future of the game.
Yeah.
That's what's going to happen, I think. I'm well into the back nine of my golfing career, but I still love to see new and innovative things. And in South Africa, we have got a multitude of innovative, amazing people who want to improve the game.
Dave, and just on a last part from my side, so you know, look at Hideki when he won. You know, when Hideki won, he moved the needle of golf in Asia entirely. It literally just got a new fresh. And what this show and Arthur and I want to do try and do with this, and that's at least our ambition, is that the more you get to know these people and their personalities and what they stand for, the more you are inclined to watch them over a 3 or 4 day period. I always say when I meet a player, let's say a week before the time, and now I see him on Super Sport, and it's a completely different viewing experience, you know? And that's what we try and do here, is bring people closer towards the common guy watching golf, because I completely agree with you that a lot of the world and determination in golf is driven by the tours around the world. But I also say in the same breath that not one of those guys is a contributor towards the economy of golf. Hear me out. They sponsored players in most capacities at that level. The amateurs is the ones that actually go and do the purchase in the retail stores, allows the club manufacturers to redevelop the new wood or bring new technology to golf, because the economy is driven by the everyday man sitting here that chirps his mates on a weekend over the golf, that has a beer and a braai afterwards, that speaks about golf in a completely non-technical way that perhaps you and Arthur are very, very familiar with. So that's what we try and do here. And Dave, on my side, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us here today. I hope that we can have this conversation with you at another stage about a few points we perhaps didn't get to today. But thank you for the role that you play in golf. Thank you that this morning you had an emotional moment with me. It will sit with me forever, Dave. The fact that you're an adopted kid was so surprising to me, and how I have learned so much about you today, and that I feel so privileged to have you in my life. And thank you for the role that you play behind the scenes in golf and what you do. And Dave, we genuinely mean that out of our heart, and that's why you are one of the first guests we wanted to bring on here, because we want to highlight people like you, the impact that you've had on it, and especially in a non-snobbish, I never find the right word, but you just bring the game so much humility towards the game, and that's what moves people forward. The CEOs that take that humility forward, that take the time to spend with other young leaders in the market, that take the time to do that, and like a Gary Player, you know, we know about so many conversations that he has behind the scenes that's never made public about the impact and the inspiration that he serves. And in your way, Dave, you do exactly the same way. And thank you very much that from my side. I know that Arthur has one more thing or something else to add.
Let's do this.
Dave, I've got a question for you. If you had your last round ever, who would that four ball be?
Yo, this is a tough one. This is a tough question because the four ball would be my wife and my two sons.
Mm. I thought it was going to go in a beautiful because of the person you are.
Yeah, I think that would be cool. I mean, you know, we play and my dad would have to be there because we've done it a couple of times. My two sons, Michael and Adam, and myself play. My dad drives with us. And I know he inspired all of us to play golf. You know, he's 88 now, still switched on, still gives me a hard time. But massive inspiration in terms of playing golf. Because my start in golf, I was a caddy when I started at Rand Park. I was a 12-year-old. I used to go and caddy there on a Saturday. I'd do 36 holes for $3.50 a round. And obviously the rest is history. But that would be my football.
That's awesome. Next question. With the South African pros right now, who do you think would be the next major champion, or who do you think would break into the top 10 next?
It's quite a tough question because we've got so many good players. So from a consistency point of view right now, Christian Besaidenhout is the guy who's making all the right moves. We've got a couple of other guys on the tour there. Dylan Fratelli has been a guy I've been watching closely for a number of years now. He's been a little disappointing this last year, but I know he's working on things, so the bigger goal is there. The most exciting golfer for me in South Africa right now is Henny du Plessis. He's now gone on to a different stage. He's made a bucket of money, and hopefully that doesn't influence his work ethic. You know, he's got a good caddy. He's got a good team around him, very good player. And then, of course, you know, we see week in and week out, we see guys who have got the potential, but the magnitude of going from where they are now to a major winner is so massive.
It's huge, yeah.
We talk about sometimes going from standard 5 to standard 6. You know, when you went, you're the king of the jungle in junior school, and you go to high school, and things change, you know, and the attitude of the people around you changes. And the ability to adapt to that, I think, is important. So in South Africa, there are so many good players. I just wish these guys would work a little harder.
Mm.
Perfect.
I was so, Eric, when we spoke to Eric, and I asked him the question, and he says, I said, you know, golf from here on. 183rd, I think, in 2018, you know, jumped up to 41st. And he said to me, I feel it's only starting. And I felt that was so awesome because it felt like he had this new drive, you know, to just say, well, South African golf is so on the go. There's so much opportunity at the moment, and he's got this new energy to take on the world. And it's not just the talking. He's implemented coaching structures in the background, his mental capacity, his body capacity. He's taken the first time since 2017, he's taken a two-month
let's call it a break. Since rehab.
You know, period. Since rehab. But that prepares him now, and it feels like he's in such a mature stage with it. I'm also very excited to see what Eric does, because if you sat next to him in this interview, Dave, I'll fear him as a player moving forward.
But you know what I must say? With Eric, he knows what he can do now.
Yeah.
He didn't know that before.
I feel the same way.
He won the PGA and it was, he had come back to South Africa, he'd been in America, he'd done all these things, came back, and he realized, hey, you know what, I can do this. So he starts that story about Georgie belonging, that he started to belong. And now he's gone to America, he's competed in a few majors.
Mm.
He's played a couple of majors.
Yeah.
He was...
And his tour card isn't that old.
He's played two majors.
He's not that old on the tour card. PGA's relatively new card.
And also what's cool... While I disagree with it, those terrible trousers that he wears, that's become his signature. Yeah. Then he had those handlebars.
And the massage.
So he understands the marketing side of it. So, and he's a wonderful guy. And as you rightly say, he's hardworking. He works with Dougie Wood, his coach.
Yeah. And his wife, Rose, what a support structure.
So his team is solid. But importantly, he's been able to realize that he could do this.
Mm.
We know Dean Burmester. For me, he's a seriously talented player. He's playing with the big boys now. Okay, he's in a big school. He's doing all the right things. He's working hard. He's a beautiful human being, Dean. Dean is starting to believe that he can be there. He's played a couple of majors now. You have to go there. You have to check it out. You have to feel the magnitude of those events. He's done that a few times. So I think we've got a couple of guys that are dipping their toe in that world. You know, you take this young guy, Wilco Nienaber. Beautiful young man, fantastic, well brought up, lovely man, has huge talent. He doesn't know how good he is yet. When he starts to work it out, that's going to be a guy. So, and we can have conversations about a multitude of these young players. But once you've been there, you know, Henny goes in the live tour, finishes in the, I think he finished second. One. He's made 60 million rand or whatever, it's crazy. He got to start believing that, hey, you know what, I belong in this space. This is me. Check out Brandon Grace. Brandon Grace went through the realities of life. He got married. He had a child. So your focus changes. Your commitment to certain things change. Gracie, his little guy, Roger's growing up now. Gracie's back on the road. He's rekindled the fire, you know, and that guy's talented. And he can hit shots. He's amazing. And he's played majors. He's competed in majors. We remember when he hit it out of bounds at 16 at that crazy golf course. He was in contention. He knows what he can do.
Mm.
So I think, you know, a guy like Eric, he's been there enough to know that that's where he can be. And then he's gone and he's revisited his whole business. He's a business. Mm. He's the product. Mm. What are the elements of my business that I need to tweak, change, do? What are the sacrifices that I need to make? What are the commitments that I need to make? And his mindset is one that he can do that. So you're 100% right. You know, we talk about that. Eric is a guy. We could sit here for a long time, talk about the potential of the South Africans. Let's look at the guys who really work hard. Dylan Fratelli works hard. I mean, he worked so hard on getting distance. I think he's compromised one or two.
He was the biggest gain on the PGA Tour in a season in ball speed.
Okay.
And he's not, I mean, he's not a big guy.
Yes.
But he's working on the right fundamentals.
Yeah. So he's gone through all of that. And perhaps that focus has, you know, maybe short game's not as good as it was, whatever. But he's a potential major winner, that guy. Mm. And then you take the kinds of courses. I think, you know, Louis for me has always been this amazing guy, just chilled, relaxed guy. He's done it in his own way, at his own time, and he's achieved amazing success. And he could still win a major.
Mm.
But you never know who's going to pitch up when Louis's there. Is it Seaside Louis or is it competitive Louis? And you just never know. Both his persona, his body language, he's always just the same. He's an amazing guy. So we've got a lot of players. We have beautiful golf courses. We have good coaches. We have good psychological and you know, support teams. We have great fitness. We have everything here. We just need to up the work ethic.
Mm.
And I think if a lot of these guys started planning their lives a little better, guys like Dylan Mostert make me excited because he works hard. He's got a focus. He's got goals. He's moving in the right direction. He's got to keep that momentum going because it's not for one season, one week, one. It's for a long time. And this is a sport. You can do that.
Mm.
You know, look at Faf de Klerk. He's an amazing guy who makes one tackle. He's out for 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Doesn't happen in golf.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you know, I think the recipe is here. The players are here. All this stuff is there. They just need to, you know, get it right. And some of them are going to get it. And, you know, based on the fact that Eric's obviously made an impression on you guys with his presence on your podcast, I hope it's him. I really do. He's a great guy.
Well, that's, you know, suppose thank you again to all the industries that are pouring money into golf and the development of golf. I mean, the Sunshine Tour with their development program that they're introducing now. I think Thomas Apt has done a wonderful job to raise the awareness on the tour. Eric reminded us the other day how competitive our tour is, you know, and how good our players are here, and how many players come here to get that experience from everybody here. Dave, once again, thank you for all your contributions and your time this morning with us. And Arthur, as always, thank you so much for being me on this. You give me great confidence in doing all of this. And to everybody that took the time to listen to this and to watch this, please let us know what you thought about it. Give us any good feedback. We're open to criticism. And this golf show is for all of us to learn a little bit more about golf, find out a little bit more behind the scenes. But also, Dave, you won't know how much inspiration will be drawn from people that listen to this today for you. And thank you for being also a great family man and raising two wonderful boys that contributed already so much towards the golf. I've always had a very keen eye on Michael, and I'm very excited for also the impact that Michael will have in the game of golf moving forward.
Thank you. Thank you guys for taking this initiative. It's really nice to have an opportunity to talk about our own people in our own town. And golf is in a good space, and long may that last. Thank you very much.
On the next episode of The Human Golf Show.
Working for a non-rights broadcaster was just becoming hard, because all you're doing is going to film the practice and the post-match stuff. So it literally becomes monotonous. Like every week it's the same thing. I could tell you what a coach is going to say, whether he wins, loses or draws. I could write the press release before he even speaks. So I got bored with it. And so that's why I then started covering golf.